So here we are. It's May and it's been very quiet on this particular site. I'm sorry, COVID has hijacked everybody's agendas. So not a lot of opportunity to sit down and do this sort of stuff, which is ironic, I know, given that so many people are actually trapped at home. So today we're going to talk about some stuff around end of life and the decision-making that has to happen when patients land in our lap in the emergency department, acutely unwell. And we'll start this by considering a case. So you've got a 74-year-old gentleman who has been delivered by ambulance with acute onset sepsis, temperature of 38.9 degrees Celsius, abdominal pain and dysuria. Everything really points clinically towards this being a urinary tract infection and not COVID as the underlying problem. On assessment, he has oxygen saturations of 91% on a non-rebreather mask at 15 litres a minute. From a circulatory perspective, he has a pulse of 135 and atrial fibrillation and a blood pressure of 76 on 40, despite having had, at this stage, 2 litres of crystalloid and having had good antibiotic cover. And his blood gas at this point in time shows a lactate of 6.2. He has a background of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. His best exercise tolerance is around about 40 metres. He doesn't use home oxygen. He has congestive cardiac failure and has New York Heart Association grade 3 symptoms. He has type 2 diabetes mellitus. He has ischemic heart disease and he's had 3 previous AMIs with an ongoing history of exertional angina. Interestingly, he has an advanced care directive, thank goodness, which says not for resus. The family, however, have turned up. And they want everything possible to be done. And the patient, at this point in time, is reconsidering his advanced care directive and thinking that he might actually like to go to intensive care and be ventilated and try and recover from this particular problem. So you can see the quandary here. A man who's got an advanced care directive, multiple comorbidities, not apparently wanting resuscitation up until this point in time, not responding to basic interventions or relatively basic interventions. And so now faced with the decision, is this a man that we should intubate? Is this a man that we should put central lines into and commence vasopressor support? Or is this someone who we should place a ceiling of care in place and call it quits at pretty much where we are currently? The pressure is really on, though, because the family are pushing. You figure that you had solid ground to stand on with the advanced care directive, but now the patient themselves is actually starting to change their mind about what they would or wouldn't want done. So what to do? Making these decisions in the emergency department is anything but easy. When you're working in a circumstance where you have got multiple competing priorities, you've got KPIs that you have to meet, you have multiple patients that you're actually looking after, decision-making is not just about the patient who's in front of you, but the group of patients for which you are responsible. And then you layer on top of that the idea that we're also responsible for resource stewardship, and it becomes quite a complicated mix. The issues you're trying to deal with, or we're trying to deal with, relate to issues around the urgency of care required, around the decisions in relation to consent, who has the authority to make decisions, who has the capacity to make decisions, and ultimately what the particular patient in this circumstance, what their prognosis is, and therefore what sort of advice you can actually give them in this sort of setting. This sort of case really is about end-of-life decision-making and end-of-life care within the emergency department. So we're going to wander through a little bit of a discussion around those sorts of issues and hopefully come up with some perspectives on how you might approach the case that I have just outlined. First thing we'll talk about is an article which came out in 2018 in Nursing, the International Journal of Nursing Studies, and it really related to what emergency clinicians think with respect to end-of-life care and end-of-life decisions within the emergency department. And there were a number of themes that come out in that. Generally, that from the clinician's perspective, care in the emergency department is mostly around living, not dying. That staff generally feel underprepared to care for dying and the family in that sort of an environment. That staff in the emergency department perceive death as a failure. that there are limited time frames available for practicing safe standards of care. It creates a fair degree of stress and distress for staff because of conflicting priorities. And there's practices of distancing behaviours, withdrawing from patients, doctors in particular devolving the care of the particular patient to the nurse rather than continue to be involved, and a sense that the emergency department is not really the appropriate place for this sort of process to occur. If you consider those results and consider the perspectives that have been shown in those results, you can see that a lot of it really relates to a sense of what is our identity or what is our role in an emergency department and an uncertainty about where we fit into this particular process. In order to work through that, we'll work through a number of concepts or principles that will relate to it. One of the first ones, principle number one, that really is one that everybody's heard before, may not know where it came from, and often gets forgotten, and it relates to doing no harm. Back in the Hippocratic Oath, there is a line which basically says to abstain from doing harm. Then in the 1800s, there was a quoted axiom from a Parisian physician by the name of Chomel, who said that it is only the second law of therapeutics to do good, its first law being this, not to do harm. In order to avoid doing harm, we have to look at the patient in terms of, if I'm going to perform an intervention of any form, is the benefit of that intervention going to outweigh any potential harm for the patient? And if the starting point for that patient is that their prognosis is abysmal, that it's extremely unlikely that they are going to recover from whatever the illness is, no matter what we do, or that if they do recover, then they are certainly not going to be back at the functional level they were before we started, then there's a serious case to be made for not commencing those therapies in the first place. That leads to the question of how do we decide who that particular group is where benefit may be outweighed by harm in terms of intervening. And that's where we think about the idea of creating resuscitation plans, and preferably it's all done ahead of time, like our patient with the advanced care directive. The sorts of things that might help the thinking, to look at some triggers, for example, the surprise question. Would you be surprised if this person died within the next 12 months, irrespective of what their current presenting problem is? Is recovery for this particular patient uncertain? Is this a patient who's had recurrent admissions with severe chronic disease? Do they have underlying progressive advanced illness? Do we think that a rapid response system is likely to be activated or anticipated to be activated premised on what their current clinical findings are? If those things are in place, then it's time to think seriously about a resuscitation plan, but also about where the limits to that resuscitation might be in particular. There are tools around to help with that process. None of them necessarily that validated. One in particular is called the Criteria for Screening and Triaging to Appropriate Alternative Care. They somehow break that down into the acronym CRISTAL. Not so important, the tool itself, in terms of a capacity for scoring. Mathematical things are rarely that useful when it comes to dealing with human beings. It is important, though, in terms of the elements that would be looked at. Those elements relate to the presence of abnormal vital signs in this particular person to the point where it's likely that they may well require a PACE call. And in particular, if they have more than one abnormal vital sign requiring a PACE call despite our interventions, usually in patients over the age of 65, but not necessarily. Also, the presence in the patients of things like advanced malignancy, chronic kidney disease, other chronic organ-based illnesses that are suggesting that they've got at least one compromised organic system in play behind whatever the acute presentation is. Then you layer on top of that things like evidence of frailty, whether or not they're someone who requires care in a nursing home or in supported accommodation. And they're key elements that are coming into play in determining, is this someone who should have an advanced care directive or a resuscitation plan with a ceiling of care, or someone who, if none of those things are present for us, whether or not we should proceed with invasive methods of support and realistically expect we're going to get a positive outcome. The second principle to think about is dignity. Again, that's been looked at in the nursing literature. There's an article from 2016, May, in the Journal of Emergency Nursing that's Loss of Dignity in End-of-Life Care in the Emergency Department, a phenomenological study with health professionals. And they looked at a number of themes around that loss of dignity. And those themes came out as, first, being exposed in a cold world, with sub-themes along the lines of we're really improvising the dying person's care, that there's a lack of space to care for the dying person. Second, we're being self-critical with our professional attitudes. We're aware that we do things that are undignified and criticise ourselves subconsciously for it. That we have a lack of a palliative culture within the emergency department. The third one is family obstinacy in hospital rescue. And the sub-themes here are making ill-advised choices and avoiding burden. If we were going to paraphrase that particular study, it would really be around the patient's loss of dignity and the lack of dignity in the processes that they are subjected to around a dying process or a critically ill process within the emergency department. As an environment that is not particularly conducive to what we see as a dignified death or dignified levels of care, that to an extent is justifiable if we're looking at a positive outcome for that particular patient. But if it is because we are going through the 21st century death ritual of making sure that no intervention has not been done before the patient dies, with no hope of benefit, then in essence we've sacrificed that person's dignity for no good of theirs and certainly no good of ours, as reflected by our self-critical professional attitudes. So far that's first, do no harm, and then dignity around this process. The third principle is, whose decision is it anyhow? Who has the decision-making capacity in terms of what should or shouldn't be done for this particular patient? The bottom line is that in most circumstances, it's the patient with decision-making capacity that does not share the decision-making authority. That is the domain of the treating health professional. What I mean by that is, just because the patient requests it, it doesn't mean that it has to happen. The treating team, the doctors, the nurses involved, advisors to the patient regarding reasonable treatment options. You don't have to refer to family or friends in that process, and the patient should be given the opportunity to participate in treatment decisions consistent with their level of decision-making capacity. So if we think of our gentleman at the start who has had an advanced care directive in place and currently wishes to change his mind, and the family are pushing to have everything done, if it's our assessment that this gentleman's prognosis is abysmal, and it certainly would seem that way, it's unlikely someone with his comorbidities and premorbid condition is going to get through the level of illness that he currently has, irrespective of what we do. If they wish for that to go ahead, they can put forward that wish, but that doesn't mandate that we carry it through. There's no legal or moral mandate for us to carry out therapy that is ostensibly futile. And if we're making that as a reasoned and rational decision, then we're under no mandate to actually carry out. Patients can make their wishes known, family can make their wishes known, but we don't have to carry forward. The other thing to consider in that sort of a setting is exactly what is the capacity of someone like this who has got severe hemodynamic compromise, who is basically showing evidence of end organ failure, and now changes his mind about something which he had, in the clear light of day, had completed like an advanced care directive. There's real questions around whether the decision making they are making at this point in time is lucid, rational, and well-informed decision making, and something that if they were given the chance in the light of day that they would repeat. An additional key consideration here is, when the patient is making this decision, on what basis are they making the decision? have we given them a clear idea of what they would expect in going through the interventions that may be on offer? Have we given them a clear idea of what they can expect to be like at the other end, in a most likely sense? Either that we can do this and they're still going to die, or we can do this and they might survive, but they will not be an independently functioning human being. They will be bedridden in a nursing home somewhere. Those sorts of clear concepts have to be communicated to the patient or the decision maker before it can really be considered an informed decision around what sort of interventions will come into play. It's very difficult to be black and white about all that. It's all we can do is really give the patient or the patient's nominated decision maker a sense of the probabilities that are at play. Nothing is ever 100% certain, but there are lots of cases where it's going to be very clear that the risk of a very bad outcome rather than a dignified ending is extreme. And so decision making would tend towards non-intervention ideally. So as mentioned, in terms of the decision making and making choices, the patient, provided they have capacity, is the prime person for that. If they don't have that capacity, then the next fallback would be to an advanced care directive. And that in New South Wales, that has to be adhered to if it's valid. So to be valid, it has to have been made voluntarily by a capable adult. It has to have been made without undue influence. And it has to be clear and unambiguous in applying to the circumstances that are being managed at this particular point in time. Failing an advanced care directive, the next question is, okay, well, who else can be involved in the decision-making? So there can be an enduring guardian, an appointed guardian, as you would know. It can be a spouse or a de facto spouse who has a close ongoing relationship with the patient. So level one, enduring guardian. Next level down is the spouse or de facto spouse. The next level down is the patient's carer. And that's a person who usually organises their care, or the person who has organised their care before they went into residential care. They have to be an unpaid person, so it can't be someone whose job it is to actually care for this particular patient. The next level down is a close friend or relative. This is someone you might consider as next of kin, and we often think in terms of speaking to the next of kin, but there are actually a number of levels down in this process in terms of the legal right to speak for the patient. So we've gone from the patient themselves to the advanced care directive to an enduring guardian to a spouse or de facto spouse to a carer who looks after this person on a regular basis. And now we're at the level of close friend or next of kin. So we're quite a few levels down. And then the final level really is the level of appealing to the guardianship division. But for the circumstances that we're considering here, it would be rare, if ever, that we're involved in discussions along these lines with the guardianship division, because that just takes too long and is a bureaucratic process. So now let's focus on the nature of those discussions. From our perspective, it's usually a case of to do or not to do. That's the question, or is it? At a base functional level, we are considering management options. Is it possible to do something and beneficial? Is it possible to do something but it's non-beneficial? Is it something that's in the grey zone? But is that what the patient's thinking or what the family's thinking? I would suggest that it probably isn't. A number of clinicians, when they approach the family, from the point of view of choose your own adventure. Here is a series of options that can be done. Which particular arms of this option would you like to have done? And that's throwing open a question to the patient and or family and or carer that they're not necessarily and usually not in a position to make any serious judgment over. They don't really have a strong comprehension of the implications of some of the decisions that and choices that would be made in that circumstance. There are also issues for us around exactly what we say when we speak to family or patient with respect to management choices. The way we present an argument or a case one way or the other will significantly influence the choice made by the patient or the carer. There have been studies done by behavioral psychologists, and they've looked at things like preference reversal. So same setting, same person, same situation, given a set of options, depending on how the physician frames that information, will result in a different outcome. So when choices are presented in terms of gains, then people are risk averse. And when choices are presented in terms of losses, people are risk seeking. So if you are presenting, for example, in this circumstance, a gain in the sense of we can allow you to die naturally here, we're going to make sure that you're absolutely comfortable, that it will be a dignified ending, then that information presented as a positive, as a natural death and a positive process, is going to allow a person to consider that as a gain for them. If we put it to them in terms of, if we don't do this, then you will die, then people will seek risk. I'll take my chances, come on, give it a go, let's go for all the invasive things. So it's the way that those options are worded can make a huge difference. There was a study done in 2015 in a high-fidelity simulation setting with emergency physicians, hospitalists, and critical care clinicians involving an elder person with end-stage cancer and life-threatening hypoxia. And when the whole process was being debriefed, many of the physicians who had used language strongly indicating the necessity of life-sustaining treatment, in this case intubation, actually, in themselves, felt that intubation was inappropriate for this patient. And the result was that many times the simulated patient was intubated contrary to their initial wishes and even contrary to what the physician felt was appropriate. And that relates very much to the use of language and the way we actually speak to patients around these types of things. As a guide and as a construct, we can approach this particular circumstance, even in the emergency department, in a fairly structured way. So step one is to make sure that you're actually set up for the process. To have the discussion, you have to have sounded out what is important for the patient involved. You have to get a sense of what's important to them. You have to get a sense of what things in life they enjoy. You have to get a sense of what they are hoping that we can achieve for them, what they are most afraid of, and also a sense of the question being, if you were to die tomorrow, what would you want to accomplish before that death happened? So what unfinished business do they have that they feel they need to deal with? That information is going to be heavily important in terms of feeding into our decision making as to what would be appropriate for that particular patient. You then need to make sure that you've prepared yourself with as much medical information as possible, and that you are dealing with the right people. So the people who are in a position to express what they see as the appropriate pathway and care for the patient. So it might be the patient if they have capacity. It may be their enduring guardian. It may be a carer. And that should happen in a circumstance or in a setting as can be made appropriate. Usually for this sort of thing, you're ending up in the resource room and it's a little cold and impersonal, but that's pretty much the best we can do. Don't forget to think about a translator or a cultural support, particularly for the Indigenous, and maintain as much privacy as the circumstances will allow. That's all fairly self-evident. That's the setup. Then there's getting a real sense of what the patient or the carer's perceptions are. What do they know about what's going on? What do they want to know about what's going on? And what do they understand about the pathway forward in terms of care at this point in time? Supply as much knowledge as you can. Importantly, give a warning shot that this is a critical circumstance, that we really are addressing a situation where the patient is likely to die. Deliver the information in small parts. Avoid medical jargon and give them as much time as circumstances allow to actually understand what it is that you're saying and get a sense from them as to whether they do understand it. Address their emotions and allow time for them. Try and resist the idea that we're going to make things better, because in this circumstance we usually can't. And then when you've finished the discussion, put forward what that will have given you a sense of what the patient wants, what the family wants, what the background social circumstances are, and what their understanding of the events at this point in time are, then I would advise that you actually put forward the circumstance in the sense that, taking all that into account, the path that we are going to take in managing this is going to be allowing you a natural death, keeping you as comfortable as possible in the process. And the reason we're going to do that is because the interventions that we would have as alternatives are not only not going to do you any good, but they are going to make the process of you dying longer and much more uncomfortable and undignified. And it's in your best interests, taking all of our discussions into account, that this is the path that we should go, in my view. I'm interested to hear your view as to whether you have any concerns about that, but we will progress down that path and then play on from there. So if we go back to the beginning, if we look at our gentleman who's 74 years of age, who has severe sepsis, who's unresponsive to relatively conservative management at this point in time with antibiotics and fluids, who has evidence of significant organ dysfunction with acidosis, lactate of 6.2, saturations of 91%, who has serious comorbidities in association with this, COPD, New York Heart Association grade 3 cardiac failure, known ischemic heart disease, and has had an advanced care directive. My personal view, after having discussed with him and the family and had a sense of what other potential contributors to the thought process there might be, if you take into account those sorts of questions, my view would be that this gentleman should not be intubated, should not receive invasive therapies, should be kept as comfortable as possible, and should be allowed a dignified death. So to sum all that up, when you're dealing with cases like this, in my view again, the best pathway forward is to get a sense of who your patient is, what their priorities are, what their capacity is in terms of decision making, to pull all of that information in together with their clinical picture, make a determination in your judgment as to the likelihood of benefit from the invasive type therapies, and then put a management pathway to the patient and or carers in relation to how you think this should go, giving them an opportunity to actually put forward any objections that you might be in a position to address. So the patient has capacity, or their carer has capacity, for some decision making about what happens, and the clinician, the doctor, has authority in terms of deciding whether particular interventions are appropriate to be deployed or not. Some food for thought for you. I'd be interested in any different perspectives from people out there. It's a complex situation to be placed in under a fair degree of stress, and there's no absolute right answer, but you can approach it from a fairly structured perspective. Until next time.